When you hear a Utahn speaking, you can usually tell where they're from. But, and this is the damnedest thing, it's hard to really pin down why. Our accent isn't a Western or a Southern drawl, really. I mean, in rural Utah, it comes close, but it's not just the accent that makes us sound like we're from around here. It's the words we choose, the way we arrange them. The composer Philip Bimstein noticed it right away when he arrived here years ago from Chicago. He had moved to Springdale, Utah in 1988, pretty much on a whim.
I knew nothing about the history of the town or the area. I knew nothing about the people that lived there. I just loved that red rock. I loved the quality of the air. And I loved space, being, you know, with these canyons in the distance. And I loved the silence. It seemed to me that this space, both physical and acoustic, created a possibility. It created a place to be and to create, to think, and that's why I think I was attracted to it. So I moved to this house on a hill, and there's a pasture right next to it, cows out there, and you know, I'd met the fellow who owned the cows. He lived 2 miles away in Rockville.
I just got out of the service.
His name was Garland Hershey.
I just got out of the service.
And he was an interesting guy, totally unlike anybody that I'd known in Chicago in every way.
Overnight with this cow.
His interests, his way of being. And that included his voice.
Whatnot. From Rockville to Hurricane.
But I didn't really focus that much on the voice until later.
We lived in Cedar for 30 years, and then after that we moved back to Rockville.
So I'd been commissioned to write a piece for an experimental music festival. And I thought, cool, I don't know what I'll do, but I'll just come up with something. And I woke up one morning, and I heard this lovely sound. Cows mooing. I was laying there in bed, I thought, that's what I'll do. I'll go down and record those cows. Then I'll cut up the tape and make some experimental piece out of it. So, next week I went down with my recorder and they wouldn't make a sound. Nothing. They just totally ignored me. So I went back into the house. I called up Garland. And he said, how are you doing? I said, I'm great. How are you? And I said, listen, Garland, I want to write a piece of music using your cows. And he said, well, that'll be all right. And I said, oh, great. I'm glad it'll be all right. But here's the problem. They're not making a sound. They're not mooing for me. Is there any way you could come over and maybe get them to moo? And he said, well, that'll be all right. So he came right over in his white pickup truck, and we went out into the pasture together, and he's telling me these stories about what makes cows moo and what it was like growing up with cows. And I was listening to his voice and thinking, not only does he tell these great, concise stories with a sense of wry humor, but there was a musicality to his voice. There was mirth to his voice. I just was captivated by it.
I mean, they took the calves away and the cows bawled because they wanted the calves, and that's how we got the...
And I think I could say that for all of the different people that grew up there, like Garland Hershey. There was sort of a generosity in the way they spoke, in the sense that you felt like you were being involved in what they were saying. They're not talking at you. They are involving you. They're sort of embracing you with their voice, with their story. So I said, hey, Garland, I got another idea. Could I put you in my piece? And he said, well, that'll be all right.
You want to know a little about, a little bit about, you want to know a little about, a little bit about, you want to know a little about, a little bit about, a little bit about my cows.
Uh-huh. And I said, Garland, can you tell me a little bit about your cows? And then the way he answered became the beginning to my piece, Garland Hershey's Cows.
Well, I'll tell you a little bit about myself.
It just stuck in my mind. Well, that'll be all right. I mean, again, that was a part of his generosity in the way he spoke. You know, it's just his readiness to give you his approval, to be agreeable. But then just the sound of it. Well, that'll be all right. You know, it's just like letting you know, like, you're good. And I hadn't heard that kind of generosity or that embrace with a voice where I grew up in Chicago. I don't think I'd heard that anywhere until I came to Southern Utah.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Utah English. Not just the characteristics of the way we speak, but whether or how it's changing. How does a Utah dialect or any way of speaking get formed? Is it malleable or is it set in place? And could you ditch your Utah accent if you wanted? There's a new book about just this from the linguist David Ellingson Eddington. It's based on a recent survey of 1,700 Utahns. We began our conversation with the question of just what Utah English is exactly. In his book, Eddington admits it's an imprecise term.
You don't just all of a sudden cross from Wendover, Utah to Wendover, Nevada and hear differences. But it's a nice cover term to kind of say in this area of the world that mainly is focused on Utah, what do people talk like? And so a lot of what I talk about in the book about Utah English does bleed over into communities like especially southern Idaho.
One of the questions you get at in the book, and we'll talk about some specifics here in a second, but one of the questions you get at is whether Utah English is truly unique. And I guess the question is, first, is it? Is it really unique? Because I get the sense that the answer is kind of, but not as unique as most people think it is. Is that right?
Yeah, maybe the best way to put it is, what is unique about Utah English isn't any particular thing or pronunciation or word, but maybe the different mixture of different elements of things that you can find in other places, but that mixture in the percentages that it is used in Utah is unique. But there are a few things that are almost unique to Utah.
Why is it? Why is Utah English interesting and distinctive? Because you lay out a couple of reasons why it might be.
Yeah.
Why is it?
Well, like I said, it's not so much that anything that happens in Utah is only in Utah. It's more the mixture.
Sure.
And so Utah gets a lot of dialectal characteristics from all sorts of different places. I mean, the Northeast, the Midwest, England, Denmark, all sorts of different influences kind of combine in Utah to have the mixture that we call Utah English.
And the reason is immigration, right?
Immigration, yep.
And immigration in those first years of the state settling. Because this is the other thing that was interesting. One of the things you mentioned in the book is Utah was, at least until the railroad came, Utah was pretty isolated for those first 20 years.
Yes.
And so that meant for that first 20 years, the linguistics, the speech, that was just sort of stewing and developing. And that became different, I guess. Is that how
yes.
you explain it?
That's true. But then it got huge migrations of people like people from England, people from Denmark. So that got added on to the original settlers.
Of course, we have to mention the LDS Church. That's another thing that makes Utah English interesting. And you, in the book, you say it's that the fact that so many Utahns belong to the LDS Church. But why would that matter to a dialect, what kind of church a person goes to?
Yeah. William Above, the founder of sociolinguistics, at one point said religion doesn't matter. But then people found that it does. What it really comes down to is members of a group, whether it be steel workers, whether it be college professors, whether it be high school jocks or whatever, people that belong to a certain group mark themselves as members of that group, and they do it by the way the bands they listen to, by the way they do their hair, by the clothes they wear, and by the way they speak. And so anytime you get a group, you will have the good possibility of getting in-group speech characteristics. Now, the reason people didn't think at first that religion mattered was, you know, if you're Catholic and you go to church on Christmas and Easter, that's really not a group. Catholicism isn't a group. But if you're, say, Orthodox Jewish or LDS, which isn't just going to church on Sunday, it's a group thing where there's a lot more interaction, then the possibility of having an in-group type of speech comes out.
Let's talk about the survey. The book is based on this survey you did. More than 1,700 Utahns took this. What were you trying to learn? Like, how did you go about doing the survey? I mean, the kinds of questions that you got at, and we'll go through some of the particular things here in a minute, but what was it that you were trying to learn in the study?
Yeah, what I really wanted to see, you know, too often studies of Utah English have really got mainly just people from the Wasatch Front. Huh. And I really wanted to be more comprehensive, and I wanted to be able to contrast different areas of the state with each other. And so it was nice to get that many people.
Let's go through a few of these characteristics. You say there are 28 of these characteristics that are assumed anyway to be a part of Utah English. Let me go through a few of these that you sort of go through in the study itself, the survey itself. One of them is the fill-feel merger. What is that? I think people will know that sort of just offhand.
Yeah, I think
what is that? What is
that? And in one of the studies we did, we found that that is one of the things that people cue into and say, that's what people do in Utah.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's saying things like, do they still make still?
Right.
In Geneva still?
At the still mill? Yeah.
At the still mill. And how do you fill today?
And so what you're saying is that people, when they hear that, they're like, that is a Utahn, right?
Yes. And it is very common, but it's interesting. Once again, you can't just say every Utahn speaks the same way.
Sure.
This is something that's more common among younger Utahns.
Really?
Older Utahns don't do it that much. So
really?
When we see something that, yeah, so this is something where the fact that it's being done more by younger people makes us believe that it's probably on its way in.
One that doesn't involve the L, that involves an N, is the pin-pen merger.
Yep. Yeah. And L's and N's are kind of similar sounds in language. But in Utah, it really tends to be L's that are doing the work.
What's the pin-pen? Describe that for those who don't know.
Yeah. Pin-pen would be and this is actually something it's found a bit in Utah, but it's very common in the South.
Oh, really?
So much that if you ask a Southerner, they'll say, you know, can you hand me that pen? And they'll say, do you mean a stickin' pin or a writin' pin?
Right. That's great.
And so that's another case where, hey, yeah, it exists in Utah, but hey, it exists in the South too. The feel-fill merger, you'll find it in the Midwest. You'll find it in Texas. You'll find it in New Mexico. It's kind of all over. But what happens sometimes is that in a particular place, it gets stigmatized or people notice it or comment on it overtly. When in other places, people don't say anything about it, so it never becomes part of what they think is the dialect of that region.
Okay, so aside from the mergers, let's talk about a few of these other characteristics. One of them is day in days of the week. So what is that? So this is Friday, Saturday, as opposed to Friday?
Friday, Saturday, Sunday, yep. And I think people, when they hear that, will say, that's old people that say it that way.
And is that not true?
And that is generally true, but it also depends on what part of the country they're from.
I loved this one as a characteristic, the alternatives to your welcome. Normally, when you respond to thank you, you would say, you're welcome. But in Utah and other places, it's not that. I mean, this is one of those things that people think only in Utah do you respond to thank you by you bet. What are the
Unless
other
you're
alternatives?
From Minnesota.
Right.
Unless you're in Minnesota. Yeah, people in Minnesota. Yeah, you can tell you're from Minnesota because you said you bet.
Yeah. Creek?
Oh, that's a big one. That is a big one. people hear that say, oh, you can tell you're from Utah. You'll find that it's a very common thing in Pennsylvania, for example. And it goes kind of along with roof.
Yeah.
It's up on the roof. I actually heard a character in one of the Harry Potter shows say roof, an Englishman. So, yeah, these things are – and, in fact, I mentioned in the book that Mark Twain put that crick in Huckleberry Finn's mouth. Right. And he definitely wasn't a Utah.
Right.
So it's common everywhere. I think what people are hearing more in that is maybe it's a rural thing.
Hmm. All right. What about when you have a soda? So there's a lot of us think of soda, and whether it's a Coke or not, sometimes it's just used to be referred to as a Coke or a pop. So the pop, soda, Coke element. This is one of those characteristics.
Yeah. And this is one of those things where generally it's hard to put a hard line on a map.
Huh.
But with this, you kind of can. But in Utah, it's kind of blurry. And that's because kind of the middle part of the U.S. is a pop area and the coasts are soda areas. But soda has been encroaching, I believe, from the West Coast. And so pop is something you'll find more among older people, older Utahns, more rural Utahns, and Utahns who are LDS.
I want to go through some vocabulary words.
They're fun.
They are. And talk about the ones that are distinctive to Utah and the ones that aren't. And it turns out there aren't that many that are distinctive to this place, but there might be a few. And one, let's start with biff, the word biff.
Biff.
Use that in a sentence, Professor, so we can sort of talk about it.
Yeah, I was coming down the ski hill. I hit a mogul and completely biffed it.
I biffed it, yeah.
Yeah, and so people, this is one of those, I heard it in Utah, therefore it must be unique to Utah, when it really isn't. And unfortunately what happens is you get some people in the media that are proponents of this without actually having data. So yeah, biff is not a Utahism.
Now definitely, here is the one that is maybe not entirely unique to this state, but this is really a Utahism, and that is the term to skip school, but not skip school or not play hooky,
slough
but to
school.
Slough.
Slough school is definitely Utahism, but it's interesting because when I studied it, I would occasionally find people from the South or some, you know, an occasional person, but so it probably was out there, but it definitely crystallized as the term in the Beehive State.
Let me come back to the earlier part of the conversation where you were talking about that you wanted to sort of find some evidence for what parts of what you were hearing were, in fact, distinctive to this place, what parts weren't. And I wanted to know, who cares? Like, why does that matter, do you think?
I guess because I'm interested in truth. So what is the truth about Utah dialect? And so I wanted to find the things – I guess the real thing I was looking for were there any surefire ways? And I guess I could say one is slough school.
Yeah.
And the other is probably to call fry bread scones.
Right.
And so those are probably the two things I came up with where you can if you hear those, you can be pretty sure that the person from Utah or bordering areas.
David Eddington, thank you very much.
Thank you. Good to be here again.
That's David Ellingson Eddington. He's an emeritus professor of linguistics at Brigham Young University. His book is called Utah English. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We're talking about Utah English today. That's the subject and the title of a new book about the way Utahns talk. And the book made us wonder if the dialect you hear in southern Utah, for example, is fading. Are all regional dialects in the U.S. fading, being flattened out by social media and globalization? And the answer we got this week is no. But dialects here and everywhere are changing. They always do, by the way. It's how language works. And that's where we're headed next with David Bowie. How does this work? Bowie is a sociolinguist. That is, he studies how culture and society shapes the way people use language. And he told us one of the things that makes this stuff difficult to measure and track is that the way we speak may fit into categories or patterns, but wouldn't you know it, everyone is different.
We could say that in all likelihood, say, a female speaker from Salt Lake City in her 40s, you know, insert any number of other social categories, probably speaks in this sort of way. But that's really at the level of populations. We don't understand yet what motivates people to behave in particular linguistic ways at an individual level. And that's a really interesting thing because anything that happens in language is happening at an individual level. Right now, anybody who's hearing this is hearing it at an individual level. And so the fact that we can talk about populations and groups and so on. And we really can say we know what we're talking about, but we can't yet get to individual motivations and individual perceptions is one of the most interesting gaps that remains.
Do we all have a tell? A part of our accent or our language that even if we've, let's say we have gone off into some sort of linguistic witness protection program and tried to hide the secrets of our past, our, you know, whatever, blue-collar background or whatever, as we make our way as an urbanite in a big city, can we ever completely hide that? Or is there that tell that might be there somewhere?
So I'm going to answer that, first of all, with an extraordinarily definitive maybe.
Okay.
And then I'm going to tell a personal story, and then I'm going to give maybe a more straightforward answer. So the personal story was from my first class in grad school with William LeBove, who ended up being my dissertation advisor. He walks in on the first day of class, and he just starts like writing things on the board and talking at the same time with his back to us. We're sitting there in the classroom and we're asking him questions as it goes on, right? This is a graduate seminar. And at one point I ask a question and he whips around and he points his chalk at me and he says, "You're from the South, aren't you?" And I kind of stutter and stammer. I'm like, "Well, I'm, you know, from south of here." This was in Philadelphia. "I'm from south of here. I'm from Maryland, south of DC." And he said, "Yeah, thought so." And he goes back, he turns back around and starts writing on the board and talking again. And I found out later that it was because of my pronunciation of the ah vowel, of all things to just key in on. So for many of us, probably, yeah. But also, it's not necessarily going to be something that anybody actually notices. In linguistics, there's this concept of salience, right? Something that you do is salient if people consciously notice it. So people might consciously notice, for example, if I, as I do when I've hung out with family and folks I grew up with for a while, if I ask, you know, "What time is it?" right? That "ah" instead of "I" in time, that Southern. For most listeners, they're not going to key in on the fact that I have an extremely what's called low back ah vowel, but a linguist might notice. So there are tells and then there are tells, right? There are things that at a technical level, yeah, there are things that are there and they're part of our linguistic inventory no matter what. And then there are the things that people are consciously aware of. And the things that people are consciously aware of, I mean, I guess because we're consciously aware of them, those are more likely to be manipulable.
When does a person's way of speaking and their accent and their dialect, all those things, when does that get set in stone? Or does it? Because you've mentioned in your writing that there does seem to be kind of this critical period for acquiring a way of speaking that, as I understand it, kind of ends at puberty. Like, is that the period of that, or does it ever really completely, as we were sort of just saying, get set in stone?
Well, we've known for a long time, since at least the 50s, the 1950s, really even earlier than that, that the linguistic system that you learn in childhood and adolescence, at least early adolescence, that is most likely to stick with you for your life. But since then, and I can say I've been one of the people who's thrown sand into the gears, since then, we've realized that there's more to it than that. That it's not just that you learn some particular way of speaking in childhood, and then that's what you do forever. Well, I mean, there's different levels, right? I mean, for example, you can always learn new words. Your whole life, you can learn new words. If you move to some place and there's some sort of local word for a food that you used to use a different word, you can learn that local word. Pronunciation is a little trickier because that seems to settle in at a different level in our cognitive system. But even there, if you are surrounded by a different system, then you start to accommodate to that. Your peers have a very strong effect on what you're doing. And of course, if you have something where you realize that people are going to look askance at you for doing some sort of linguistic thing, then you have some sort of reason to change it, or maybe to double down on it and make it even stronger, because that's a possible outcome as well. And then the work that I've been doing over the past, I don't know, decade and a half, 2 decades, has been looking at what individuals do across the lifespan. So middle to older adulthood. And really what I've found is that, I mean, these are probably unconscious processes, but even unconsciously, each individual is free to chart their own path. It's not like there's a particular trend that people have across the lifespan. It's that people get to decide themselves what they're going to do linguistically within certain parameters, right? You're not going to wake up tomorrow and suddenly be speaking, I don't know, Cantonese if you've never had a chance to learn it. But maybe tomorrow you're like, you know what? This is the part of my identity that I'm going to present today. And maybe for me, that's I'm going to present myself as the Southerner I grew up as. And so I'm more likely to say, what time is it than what time is it?
Right. Well, doesn't it get to that larger question here, this larger factor that, as you describe in your own work and some of the papers that you've written, that there are these social factors like gender, like class, like ethnicity that influence the way a person chooses to speak and the features of the language that they select. So on one hand, there is our background. There's the kind of, I suppose it's, you could say it's the nature part that settles in some way when around puberty. But then there's the other part that said, so it's a melange of all these things, I guess, is what you're saying.
Yeah, sometimes I like to freak out my students by telling them to imagine an n-dimensional space where we are points in that space. And all of these dimensions are our social realities and also some things beyond that, right? Our cognitive realities, for example, our physical realities. You know, maybe we you know, ate something that was really hard to chew and our jaw muscles are tired. That probably factors in as well. And so along all these axes, we're at a particular point. And that's the way we behave linguistically. So, yeah, at some level, we contain this maybe even uncountable number of identity realities. And working within those and the intersection of all of those is where we're in at any given point in time. And we reflect that with language.
Yeah. So is there such a thing as an authentic way of speaking where people aren't self-conscious of class and identity? You know, one that isn't fraught with trying to be part of a particular class or group or try to run from our past. Does that sort of person, in a normal circumstance, I suppose, does that person, could we do that? Is there an authentic way?
Well, I mean, I don't know that it has to be fraught, right? So however it is that we're presenting ourselves, that's how we're presenting ourselves. So I guess you could say that we're authentically whoever it is that we're being at any given time. And yeah, so if you think about what we're trying to present, we're usually not doing this consciously. This is usually something that just comes natural to the situation. And so we don't have to stress about it. Now, sometimes we do, right? I mean, there are certain things where people worry about language and the way language works and the way they're using language. But for those, I would say that really, honestly, whether you pronounce a word a certain way or not, or whether you use a particular word for something or not, you know, since it's different presentations of who you're being at a given time, it's no more that one of those is right or wrong or authentic or inauthentic any more than, you know, a different shade of blue is an authentic or inauthentic blue.
David Bowie, he's a sociolinguist and a professor of English at the University of Alaska at Anchorage. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We're talking about Utah English today. It's the subject and the title of a new book about the way Utahns talk, and it's giving us a chance to ask how Utah language is changing. We spoke with David Bowie this week. He's a sociolinguist. That is, he studies how culture and society shapes the way people speak. Bowie grew up and was educated on the East Coast, but his first job out of grad school was here in Utah. And he noticed all the typical things about Utah English. But one thing that really caught his attention is that we Utahns think a lot about what we sound like.
I particularly became fascinated with the fact that in Utah, people actually talk about the local accent in ways that you don't always get. And so my very early work when I arrived in Utah was actually investigating some of these, I don't know, stereotypes, shibboleths, whatever you want to call them, of Utah English. So I did some publishing on the technical term is the card-cord merger, but it's the stereotypical, instead of Spanish fork, saying Spanish fark. And looking at the historical development of that and how and when it entered Utah English and what was happening at the time. So
can I just say, before you move on from that, because I read a little bit of your work on that, and I think we should just mention that you've written about that, the fact that cord-card merger in part came from when Mormon pioneers lived in Missouri for a time, because that's the way people in, I guess, St. Louis spoke in the 19th century. So Mormon pioneers who were passing through, the young ones anyway, took hold of that cord-card merger and brought it to Utah. the Deseret territory. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. That sort of, I guess, stay, or whatever you would call it, in Missouri and Illinois has had some clear linguistic effects, and the cord card merger is probably the primary one among them. And actually, you still get that merger, you know, over time it's changed in different ways, but you still get essentially that merger in the St. Louis area, though as it is along the Wasatch Front of Utah, it is in St. Louis fading out in favor of certain other forms. But yeah, there's a clear historical link to be drawn, which is the case actually for a lot of things, right? If you take a language and you settle it in a new location where that language hasn't been settled before, then of course the people bringing that language in, they're setting the initial form of it, and so that's going to have echoes over time.
So when we're talking about languages being, you know, one of the being influenced by social factors, one of the things you found, and this is certainly the case in Utah English, is that religion also is one of those social identities that influences dialect and those kinds of things. I guess the question is, so do Utah Mormons speak differently than non-Mormons? You wrote a paper about this, I think it was back in 2014.
Yeah, and that one I can actually give a definitive answer. The answer is yes. I will say the differences are fairly small, right? I mean, it's not massive differences, but yes, there are meaningful, measurable differences in pronunciation between Utah Mormons and Utah non-Mormons. Now, I should add the disclaimer that we were only looking at the Southern Wasatch Front, but we do have some indications that elsewhere in that area, you get the same effect.
So let me ask you this. So do you think if you were listening to someone during that period and they lived in that area that you were studying, you could have heard them speak for a while and said, you're a Latter-day Saint, you're not? Was it pronounced enough that you were hearing in the way they spoke that you could make a distinction in some way?
So it probably depends on whether you mean a specific you or a general you in that. So as a specific you, I could probably train myself to do so. Like I said, these are small differences, but they're consistent enough to be statistically meaningful.
Well, give us an example.
Okay. These are really subtle distinctions. But for example, the vowel I, as in the word hide, if you make that vowel, if you make an I, your tongue actually has to move during it. And in our work, we found that when Mormons and non-Mormons produce that vowel, their tongue starts in the same location, but in the process of moving it, Mormons move their tongue further forward in the mouth by the end of it. So the distinction, like I said, is very subtle, but it's something like, and I'm going to exaggerate this a little, hide versus hide. Hide, hide. And that probably wasn't fully audible, right, if you're just listening. But the tongue ends up in a different location. Now, the real question that I have, and the one that we haven't investigated yet, is whether Utah residents key in on things like this. Because the production is different, but where we still have a gap is the perception. And that's kind of the next step.
That is amazing. Yeah. That you can,
right?
That you can, it is. But the other thing that's interesting about your paper is you also broke down that distinction even further. This is even, to me, even more wild, is that you broke it down further to ask whether there was also a difference between
Mormons who go to church, you know, who actively participate in the faith, and those who don't. And I guess what you found is that it matters if you're an active Latter-day Saint or a non-practicing member in the way you speak. There's a difference there too, right?
Yeah. So what we found is you have these, and I should probably stress that on the vast majority of features, Mormons and non-Mormons pronounce them exactly the same. But on the ones where there is a difference, where Mormons and non-Mormons produce things differently, yeah, we did find that there's a difference between active Mormons and inactive Mormons. And it was different for different features of pronunciation. But inactive Mormons tended to either fall in between the two, which, I mean, makes sense, right? That's what you would expect. Or, for some features, inactive Mormons were more different from the active Mormons than the non-Mormons were. So, almost an overshoot of the non-Mormon target. And that's just fascinating.
And that tells you what? Because if the basic finding is clear that this is a matter of social identity, and so when you change that social identity, and in this case, you stop going to church or, you know, you leave the faith or whatever, that means that the way, even in very subtle ways, let's be clear, but you use the language differently in some way. And to me, I'm like, why would you do that? If you stopped going to church, is it that you somehow through these deeply subtle ways you want to signal to other people, maybe faithful people or maybe people who are also no longer believers or whatever, that that's where you are? Or is this even a conscious thing?
I am about as certain as I can be as a researcher that this is not consciously done, that this is below the level of consciousness. But the way to describe it, perhaps, is imagine that at any given point, you're deciding who you're going to be that day, right? Because we have a lot of different things that we can be. Right now, you're a radio broadcaster and I'm a professor. But when I go home tonight, I'm not really going to be a professor in the same way, right? And when you go home, you're not going to be a radio broadcaster in the same way. We're going to have different social realities that we're inhabiting. We're going to have different identities. So we actually, all of us, have this field of social identities that we can project. And we do this various ways, right? It's not just language. It's the way you hold your body. It's the hand gestures that you make. It's the clothes that you wear even, right? And language, that's part of it. And so we pick what we're going to do. And the way that we know what to target is because of the linguistic input that we've gotten. And we know perhaps something of the identities of other people, and they tend to cluster over here. So that's going to be my target. Well, if then you change your identity, then you can also change your linguistic targets, because the input that you have for that new identity is a different target. And so at any given time, you know, we're not making huge changes, but we are making changes where we're vectoring ourselves toward, here's who I am. And if who I am changes, then I'm going to change the way I'm presenting myself.
You said earlier that one thing you noticed about the Utah way of speaking or the Utah accent was that Utah was different in that they were self, I don't know if you said self-conscious, but you said that they were aware of, that they talked about the Utah accent and way of speaking. I'll be honest, this radio program is endlessly fascinated in the Utah accent. We've talked about this a lot. So what does that say about us? Why are we caught up in talking about our accent and our way of speaking, do you think?
I don't know, right? I mean, I do know, like, I grew up in the South, in the Upper South. And I know why Southerners talk about their accent, and it's because other people make fun of you. But people don't make fun of the Utah accent in that way. Although I will say I have talked to a number of Utahns who believe that their accent gets made fun of, which is an interesting bit of linguistic insecurity, which is okay. Linguistic insecurity is a very widespread thing.
Well,
Lots of people have that answer? Don't worry.
Right, right. But is that the answer? We're insecure. We're an insecure people.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't put it that way. Linguistic insecurity is a specific thing. It doesn't say you're an insecure people, right?
Okay.
But linguistic insecurity in the sense of people believing either that the way that they're speaking is wrong or believing that everybody else believes the way that you're speaking is wrong, right? That's, I think, a very real thing, and it's very widespread. Lots of people exhibit that all across the industrialized world. I mean, it transcends language boundaries. Well, and so if you have linguistic insecurity at a fairly high level, then people are going to be much more aware of language. They might not be aware of what's going on linguistically in a, I don't know, I hate to put it this way, but a technically correct sense. But at least aware that something's happening, that something's going on, and it's something that's available to talk about in a sort of deeper, more substantive way than areas where people are like, oh yeah, everybody talks like me, and if they don't talk like me, then they're talking wrong, so why should I care?
Do you think the distinctive Utah way of speaking and the Utah accent, that is being diluted, fading away? Like in central Utah when they say wash instead of wash, or in southern Utah when they say milk instead of milk, or that card cord merger that we were talking about that you find in parts of Utah, still find. You mentioned that one was sort of fading away in Missouri, I suppose. So is it fading away here? Is Utah English going to be less like the Utah English some of us grew up with, I guess?
So in answer to that specific question that you ended with, is Utah English going to be different than what you grew up with? The answer is yes, but that doesn't necessarily mean what it sounds like at first. Because in answer to the question, is Utah English fading away? The answer is no. What's happening, and I want to stress, this is not unique to Utah, right? This is everywhere that language is in use. What happens is that certain features that people use in a particular region or a particular purpose, certain features fade away, certain features remain static, and certain features increase or even are newly introduced. What you have is just this constant process of change. The one constant that linguists have found is that if people are using a language, and if people are using a certain dialect of a language, it is in process of change. No language, no dialect ever remains static. So, yeah, is Utah English going to be different than what you grew up with? Absolutely. Is Utah English no longer going to be Utah English? No, it's still going to be. It's just going to be in a somewhat different form.
David Bowie, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
David Bowie, he's a sociolinguist, also a professor of English at the University of Alaska at Anchorage. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Elle Cowley, the program produced by Tim Slover and Benjamin Bombard. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.